Father, tonight we're grateful for a wonderful time of fellowship in the meatball supper. Thank you for the opportunity to gather together like that. What a wonderful, wonderful time. Now, Lord, as we continue on this night, feasting on your word, help us to learn from probably one of the most tragic episodes in the entire Bible, and that is the life of Saul. Help us to learn from this, to grow in it, and that we might avoid the sadness that is his life. So open your word to our hearts and open our hearts to your word, for we ask it in Jesus' name, and all God's saints said, amen. All right, we looked at Saul for the first time last week. We're going to finish up with Saul tonight. Saul's life can be really divided into three parts. The part where things are going good for him, where his life is getting exciting and he's becoming anointed to be king. Then the rebellion, where he rebels against God. And then Saul, the one who just sort of rages and has fits and is constantly paranoid and envious of David. As I mentioned to you earlier, the way the Bible's put together, particularly the way the Bible is put together in 1 Samuel, there's overlap, what I call biographical overlap. You don't know when one story starts and one story ends. And that's going to happen tonight. Tonight we're going to be introduced to one of the most significant figures of the entire Bible, certainly one of the most significant figures of the Old Testament, and the most significant figure of the history and the monarchy of Israel. And of course, that's none other than David. We will get to see him, but it's not David's story just yet. It's still Saul's story, which is kind of funny because some of the more interesting accounts of David's life are found here, probably the most famous one, because typically you have a hard time saying David and without saying Goliath, or Davy and Goliath, if you happen to watch the claymation growing up. I did not. I was not allowed to. My family didn't go to church, for crying out loud, or barely went to church. So be that as it may, David and Goliath. And oddly enough, this story is a transitional story. It's a transitional story between what's going on in that particular life of Saul and the upswing of the life of David. Can we get that door set back there? Just, if you don't mind doing that, Paul, that'd be great. Love to have the youngsters around, but... So with that in mind, we're going to start with chapter 16. There's another thing about chapter 16 I need to tell you about it. It's screwy. It's screwy. Most people don't like talking about things that are difficulties in the Bible, but this is a difficulty of the Bible that is just... You can't ignore it. There is a significant difficulty of the Bible here, and it has to do with the Bible's chronology. In chapter 16, you come across the person of David, and you sort of kind of have question marks about how he's introduced. He's introduced as Samuel comes to town to anoint him to be king of all Israel, while Saul still is king. And then we find out that David is sort of drafted into Saul's company to be an armor bearer and to be a musician to calm him down. That's chapter 16. That's kind of how it ends. And then chapter 17, you have David going out and seeing his brothers fight in the battle against the Philistines and then see Goliath. And then David saying, hey, I'll go fight this guy. And Saul say, who are you? What do you mean, who are you? This guy was David's armor bearer. This guy would sing songs to Saul. How can that be? There is a problem here that a lot of people have looked at and tried to figure out what's the chronology here. How does this all fit together? Because if you go from chapter 16 to chapter 17 to chapter 18, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. Something's goofy here. And there is, I think, a solution to it, but we'll have to see. Lots of people have tried to come up with solutions that fit this, but be that as it may, let's take a look. That's chapter 16 of 1 Samuel. Wayne, would you mind hitting that there for us?
The Lord said to Samuel, "How long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided for myself a king among his sons." And Samuel said, "How can I go? If Saul hears it, he will kill me." And the Lord said, "Take a heifer with you and say, 'I have come to sacrifice to the Lord,' and invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what to do. And you shall anoint for me him whom I declare to you." Samuel did what the Lord commanded and came to Bethlehem. The elders of the city came to meet him trembling and said, "Do you come peaceably?" And he said, "Peaceably. I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice." And he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. When they came, he looked on Eliab and thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before him." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart."
Okay, there is probably your best takeaway verse for tonight, perhaps one of the best takeaway verses from all of 1 Samuel. As people, we look on others' outward appearances. We try to sort of judge them predicated upon any number of standards that we have set. There are all kinds of standards that we would look for in a king at this particular time. The reason they chose, they wanted Saul to be their king is because, number one, he was studly, he was good-looking. Number two, he was from a wealthy family. And number three, he was a big dude. He was tall. You know, obviously the part that would look as a really good military leader. So that's what you see. But look what you get. You get Saul. Saul, who has, you will recall, disobeyed with regard to sacrificing, trying to take the role of the priest. Saul, who wanted to have his son Jonathan killed for an incredibly capricious reason, just the dumbest reason of all, and Saul, who has failed with regard to the matter of dispatching the Amalekites. He has not been wholehearted and all that. So obviously, this is a slam, if you would, against Saul, but also it's a cautionary tale. It's something that I think that all of us need to kind of internalize, and if we don't take anything away from this whole episode of Saul's life, this is the one thing that we should take away, that God is not all that interested in outward appearances. God's interested in what's inside of us. And so there you have the little commentary that he makes. Go ahead and keep reading that.
Then Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel. And he said, "Neither has the Lord chosen this one." Then Jesse made Shammah pass by. And he said, "Neither has the Lord chosen this one." And Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel. And Samuel said to Jesse, "The Lord has not chosen these." Then Samuel said to Jesse, "Are all your sons here?" And he said, "There remains yet the youngest, but behold, he is keeping the sheep." And Samuel said to Jesse, "Send."
Why is he keeping the sheep? You know, we want to assign all kind of reasons for this. We want to think because we think David's a great guy, right? I mean, David's wonderful. David's a King David. He's a man after God's own heart. We want to think David is this majestic person that Michelangelo carves a statue out of. And just think, when we see the proportions of him, we just are in awe of the statue that Michelangelo carves. I mean, it's just amazing. This is David. Not the Bible David. And not a David that you might think about either. Because let's think about this. Any of you that have had more than one child, about something about children. Generally, at one period in time, there's one that's a goof-off. And in order to deal with that goof-off, you give them extra measures, let's just say that, extra chores, extra things that need to be taken care of in life. I mean, there are things that they just need to do. And if you have even more than, you know, a few kids, there's always just that one who's just the plain goofball that you can't get to do what you want him to do. So here are all the sons that he says, well, take this guy first. See how great this guy is. This is my pride and joy here. Well, if not him, how about this guy? Well, how about this guy? How about seven? And then realize, oh my goodness, it can't be. Not David. No, you don't know what you're talking about. Not David. Now, that's not to say that David is maybe goofball is not the right word. David is just interested in other things in the world. David has all sorts of ADD kind of things, perhaps we might want to think about. He wants to go out. I mean, he goes out, and what's he do? Later we'll find out that as he's guarding the sheep, he gets this great idea to kill bears and lions with his bare hands. I mean, this is not a smart thing to do. This is just not a smart thing to do, but he's kind of doing it. He's that kind of guy. I mean, he's the kind of guy that's off climbing a cliff or something like that, and you know, you wonder, you go, he's the kind of 2.5-year-old that you come into your dining room and you find him swinging from the chandelier. That this is the kind of 2.5-year-old we're talking about. This is kind of the personality that is going to develop with David. You're going to see this again when we start looking at actually David. But I just want to kind of get a sense for what we're getting here. He is the antithesis of Saul. He's the absolute antithesis of Saul. Whereas Saul, you kind of see this guy that, of course, you'd pick him for everything. David is kind of like, really? I mean, do we have to bring him out here? I mean, we sent him off into the fields here. So that's what we have with David. And again, that's who he picked. Then we read, go ahead, Robert. What's that? Where does David's devoutness come in terms of his allegiance to Saul? That is undoubtedly the most interesting feature of David, is that David is unbelievably loyal to Saul, even though Saul is completely unworthy of it. David is completely loyal to Saul. And that's a fascinating thing. We're going to get into that a little bit. But we're going to look at that more when we talk about David than when we talk about Saul. We want to finish up with Saul. As I said, there's a blending here, and there's kind of a no man's land between these sort of things here. Let's skip ahead to verse 14. I'll go ahead and read this. It says, now the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul. That's scary. That should get your attention. And an evil spirit from the Lord tormented him. Now, of course, this has troubled a lot of people. You know, do evil spirits come from God? Well, I'm not sure about that, but this is a question that does bother people from time to time. And we probably could have a very long discussion about that. But we want to do get through this stuff tonight. Grab me some time, and we'll go out to lunch, and we'll talk about that, okay? As long as you prep me for it, so I don't have to, so I come with my stack of notes, all right? But behold, Saul says, behold, now an evil spirit from God is tormenting you. Let our Lord now command your servants who come before you, seek out a man skillful in playing the lyre, and when an evil spirit from God is upon you, he will play it, and you will be well. And what happens is this, is that there is an old saying that music calms the savage beast. And that's what happens with Saul, is that David is expert at playing the lyre, which is a stringed instrument, and in his abilities to play the lyre, he calms Saul down. And so this is where you would see that, wait a minute, David and Saul know each other. Saul knows David, and we get this going on, and Saul has this this impact upon David's life. Okay, now, David, verse 21, and David came to Saul, he entered into his service. Now listen to this, verse 21. And Saul loved him greatly, and he became his armor-bearer. And Saul sent to Jesse, saying, let David remain in my service, for he has found favor in my sight. And whenever an evil spirit from God was upon Saul, David took the lyre and he played it with his hand. So Saul was refreshed and was well, and the evil spirit departed from him. Okay? That's verse 16. All right? So there's this relationship going on. Now, what comes next is the very famous story of David and Goliath, which we will look at on the 3rd. Okay? We will look at the story of David and Goliath on the 3rd. But suffice it to say, what's going on is this, is that Saul's got himself a bit of a problem. Goliath is there. Now, Goliath is a what? A giant. Now, there are a couple Hebrew words that indicate that the word Nephilim, you may have heard that before, Nephilim, that's from Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 4. The Nephilim get wiped out, supposedly, in the flood, but then we see them again in Numbers 13. Well, how does that mean? Well, Nephilim probably is not a title as it is a description, meaning big, bad dudes. Big, bad dudes. There's another word in Hebrew, Rephaim, the Rephaim, and they're also supposedly this race of people, and there's one guy whose bed is supposedly 9 feet long, that he's so big he has to have a bed 9 feet long. Now, we haven't found any archaeological evidence of people being of that size. Instead, we find archaeological evidence of people being kind of 5'2", 5'3", 5'4", 5'5". And so at 6 foot, Saul probably, if he was 6 feet tall, Saul would have been a big guy. But a guy that's 9 feet tall would be huge. Absolutely huge. And so there is some discussion about this. But you also need to understand something, and this is an important thing for us to keep in mind. Preserving animal remains is a difficult task. You have to want to have it happen. You have to go about making it happen. Or, like fossils are hard to come by. They truly are. They're truly hard to come by, and we need to keep that in mind. So the fact that there's no evidence of that falls under the category of the thing that I've told you once before, that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, meaning that just because we don't have bones of somebody like this doesn't necessarily mean that it doesn't exist. Let me give you a classic example of this, so you not to think that I'm just spouting this nonsense off. In the 18th century, skeptics already were arising, questioning the veracity and truth of the Bible. And one of the things that they liked to alight upon was the fact that nowhere in the archaeological record of the ancient Near East could anyone find the city of Nineveh. It just wasn't there. It was nowhere to be found. And so skeptics would point out that this was a mythological place and simply did not exist. And so therefore, because we don't have the evidence of it, it must not be, and therefore the truth of Scripture was called into question. Until somebody discovered Nineveh and unearthed this city, which was right where it was supposed to be, and described exactly how it is, and named as it was, and then they found it, and that was in the either late 18th century or early 19th century. So the saying, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, it's something they've used carefully, but at the same time, just because we don't have bones of big people doesn't mean big people didn't exist. So it's certainly fitting. The idea is this. If Goliath was a bad dude, he'd go out and tell people he's going to kick their butts and take their names and so forth. Anyway, we'll save the story about Goliath at the end until the 3rd. Suffice it to say, Saul's real happy to send this guy out, who's David. Chapter 17 is quite long, and we will look at that in greater detail because it really pertains more to David than it does Saul. But there are some things, picking up with verse 55. I want to go ahead and read that, verse 55 of chapter 17.
As soon as Saul saw David go out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" And Abner said, "As your soul lives, O king, I do not know."
Wow, Abner and Saul have both met him before, at least if you take this in chronological order. Okay, keep reading.
And the king said, "Inquire whose son this boy is." As soon as David returned from the striking down of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." As soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David, and his armor, and even his sword and his bow and his belt. And David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him, so that Saul sent him over the men, set him over the men of war. And this was good in the sight of all the people.
Okay, stop here. Now, here's where you got to place things, maybe piece things together. A lot of times we tend to think of history as being a camcorder that's running and covering every detail, okay? We got to think a little outside the box here, because my understanding of what's going on here as far as a solution to the problem of when did Saul meet David and when did they all come together is kind of resolved right here. What likely you have is two parallel accounts going on. Two accounts, and again, as I said, the fusion of David's story and the fusion of Saul's story, and the editor is trying to weave these things together. That being the case, this would be a good place to understand that the stuff that's in 16 actually probably takes place right about here. This would be a good place for it to start. That really, in terms of a chronology, that the first time that you see David is either him being anointed by Samuel in sort of a separate incident, then this break of him going out and fighting Goliath, then now, at this point where we're at in the story of Goliath at chapter 8, verse 5, that's where the story of him becoming the armor bearer comes in. Okay, he becomes the armor bearer, and you can just kind of take it off from there. And from that point forward, it's not as rough as a transition to understand all this. All you have to do is simply take the material that's there, which we know was edited. I mean, we know that there was one person down the line, somewhere in the distant future from the events mentioned here, that was putting all this together, and maybe for whatever reason, they put it together the way that they did, but another way to put it together is like this, and that way you have this more seamless understanding of the two stories. Okay? Is that helpful? Because otherwise, you'll sit there and scratch your head and say, how can this be? You will just scratch your head and say, this just cannot be the case. Because how can Saul not know this guy who he's already known intimately before, and it just doesn't make any sense, okay? This is one of the few places in the Bible like this. There's maybe one or two other places like this, but this is one of the most conspicuous and obvious ones where you do kind of need to think this through a little bit to get a better understanding of this. Plus, it also gives you a picture of Saul. You see Saul as this person who is spinning out of control. His life is obviously been affected by the fact that God has withdrawn himself, withdrawn his favor, withdrawn his spirit. And that's one way that you can possibly look at the issue of this evil spirit that comes upon him. The fact of the matter is this, is that if you remove something, well, then something, nature abhors a vacuum, right? Nature abhors a vacuum. And I would imagine the spiritual world is the same way. That in the spiritual world, that also abhors a vacuum. And when you remove that spirit of God, well, all kinds of other awful things can creep in and make themselves known and present in the life of Saul. So Saul's in a bad way here. Saul's in a really, really bad way. Because the Spirit of God has left him, and he has David now to take care of things in terms of his spiritual well-being by playing songs to him. Which is also kind of interesting because we do know something else about David. We know David from the following sources. We know David from the description of David more contemporaneous to himself, found in 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. We know David from how future historians would look at him, from what's said in 1 Chronicles. But we also know David from him being an author of music, an author of poetry, an author of songs. And so this fits well with what we know about who he was. And also, when you read some of the Psalms that kind of line up with the historical aspect, you start to see how something could be like this. And there are Psalms which mention the fact that he is being chased by Saul and life's not good for him right now, and he cries out to God. So having him being a musician to Saul is not that outside the realm of possibility, or certainly believability. But that's not all that he does. Because he's such a scrapper, David decides to do stuff. David decides to take on the Philistines, which he does handily with the help of his slingshot. Let's read on a little bit. Pick up with verse 6.
As they were coming home, when David returned from striking down the Philistine, the women came out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with songs of joy, and with musical instruments. And the women sang to one another as they celebrated, "Saul has struck down his thousands, and David his 10,000."
Okay, let's just stop here for a second here. Can we guess how this is going to go? Can we guess how this is going to go? But actually, there's something here that's an incredible leadership mistake on Saul's part. One of the things that I have learned over ministry, I've been doing this for about 30 years now, one of the things that I've learned is that if you're going to be successful in what you do in this realm of ministry, you better surround yourself with highly competent people. Highly competent people that are so competent that people will praise them. And that their competence in what they do is so obvious that they're going to get a lot of praise. And you better be comfortable with that. Because if you're not, you're going to wind up like Saul. Because it's not about you. It's not about you. It's about the kingdom mission. And that's the important thing. That's the thing that Saul missed. Saul missed the idea that this is about the mission of advancing the kingdom. This is about what God is up to. Saul missed that point. Saul kind of focuses on himself, which is a temptation that we all run into. We all run into this temptation. But it's not a good one. And this is so counterintuitive, because the fact of the matter is we love getting stroked. We love getting praise. We love that. And there's just something about us when we think, you know, hey, I'm the alpha male here. I'm the top dog here. Why am I not getting praise for killing 10,000? David kills 10,000. I only get credit for killing 1,000. You know, we tend to complain about that. We tend to think that, you know, our efforts are not being recognized, and we start getting cranky, and you know what happens? Not good stuff. Not good stuff. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's a cycle that you just can't get a hold of. And I'm going to tell you something. You see this happen all the time. You see it happen. And this is an incredibly important leadership. I don't care what you do. This is important for leadership. Surround yourself with good and capable people. That's what you want to do. You certainly don't want to surround yourself with people who are incompetent clods. But David was an incredibly competent person in what he did, and Saul failed to realize that important piece right there. I cannot stress this enough. And again, that this is where Saul really starts to unravel in a big way. And it's because of something called envy. And envy is something that is as contemporaneous as today. And that sometimes people say, well, you know, the Bible is an old book. It really doesn't speak to today's problem. Well, I want to tell you something. I've known a lot of people whose lives have been ruined because they have involved themselves in the envy of others. And this is an extremely cautionary tale, as I mentioned before. So we see this here, that Saul is starting to get a little bit... And go ahead and keep reading what the result is.
And Saul was very angry, and this saying displeased him. He said, they have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed thousands. And what more can he have but the kingdom? And Saul eyed David from that day on. The next day, a harmful spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house while David was playing the lyre, as he did day by day. Saul had his spear in his hand, and Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, I will pin David to the wall. But David evaded him twice. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but he had departed from Saul. So Saul removed him from his presence and made him a commander of 1,000, and he went out and came in before the people, and David had success in all his undertakings, for the Lord was with him. And when Saul saw that he had great success, he stood in fearful awe of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David, for he went out and came in before them.
And they would love Saul, too, if Saul wasn't so paranoid and hung up with envy. Again, it's very obvious what's going on here. If Saul tries to remove him, sort of put him out in the hinterland, well, you know what happens then is that he only succeeds more. Just as kind of an aside here, there's a principle here that's helpful for us as Christian people. It's helpful for us as a church. A lot of times we want to get involved in an endeavor and we'll say, Lord, bless this endeavor. And it might seem very godly and very holy. And it might be a really bad thing to pray, because it might not be godly and holy. Instead, we should be asking ourselves in prayer, rather than, Lord, bless what we're about to do, Lord, what are you blessing, and how can I be a part of that? Where do I fit in that blessing? I mean, that fits for us as individual Christians, that fits for us as a corporate congregation, and I think that's something that's particularly critical for us, and we kind of see it here. You know, so instead of saying, you know, God bless me and what I'm doing here, and I'm just, and this thing that you're blessing, David, I'm just going to send away. No, he should be saying, incorporate David into the, you know, the inner circle of what's going on here, and see how that all works. It worked really well for David. I mean, God, you know, wherever David went, God was blessing. That's what God was doing. I think it's important for us to see that as well. And so that's the thing that we need to be praying. Not, Lord, bless what I'm about ready to do, but, Lord, what are you blessing, and where do I fit in that? Different way of looking at asking God's blessing. So this is an interesting thing. There's a lot of stuff like that. There's all sorts of leadership and life lessons that are found right here in these pages. And unfortunately, they're by negative example. But you can learn from that. You can learn from that. Okay, going forward. All right, this next part is kind of fun. Go ahead and keep reading.
Then Saul said to David, here is my elder daughter, Merab. I will give her to you for a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles.
Mm-hmm.
For Saul thought, let not my hand be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him.
Now this is kind of a crazy thought here. Not that I want him to be my son-in-law. I want the Philistines to kill him. So I'm going to marry him off and then have him be the head guy to go out and get killed by the Philistines. Keep on.
And David said to Saul, who am I? And who are my relatives, my father's clan in Israel, that I should be son-in-law to the king?
David is expressing humility.
But at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, she was given to Adriel, the Meholathite, for a wife. Now, Saul's daughter Michal loved David.
Wow.
And they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. Saul thought, let me give her to him, that she may be a snare for him.
Wow!
And that the hand of the Philistines may be against him.
Wow!
Therefore Saul said to David a second time,
You
shall now be my son-in-law. And Saul commanded his servants, speak to David in private, and say, behold, the king has delight in you, and all his servants love you.
Well, that part's true. First part was a lie, second part's true.
Now then, become the king's son-in-law. And Saul's servants spoke these words in the ears of David. And David said, does it seem to you a little thing to become the king's son-in-law, since I am a poor man and have no reputation? And the servants of Saul said to him, thus and so did David speak. And Saul said, thus shall you say to David.
Can't you say it yourself, Saul?
The king desires no bride price.
Listen to this.
Except 100 foreskins of the Philistines.
Now, do you think they're just going to volunteer these things? I mean, do you think they're just going to say, yeah, here, it's yours? I don't think so. I don't think so. This is one of my favorite, you can imagine. This is where the junior high boy in me comes out. So, nevertheless, keep going.
That he may be avenged of the king's enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines.
Yeah, because one of these guys is going to kill him. As I said, you know, over my dead body am I going to give you the life by my clippity-clip. Keep going.
And when his servants told David these words, it pleased David well to be the king's son-in-law.
Now, this tells you something about the nature of David. Remember I said there's something off about this guy? Okay, keep going. He said, well, heck.
Before the time had expired, David arose and went, along with his men, and killed 200 of the Philistines. And David brought their foreskins, which were given in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. And Saul gave him his daughter Michal for a wife. But when Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, Saul was even more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy continually.
Okay, now, back up in verse 12, it also said, Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him and had departed from Saul. So we see again this paranoia that Saul, but it's not, you know, Woody Allen once said something, you know, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean people aren't really out to get you. Which is true. The fact of the matter is that Saul is noticing what's going on. But this whole business of the, 200 Philistine foreskins, I want you to think about this for a second. I mean, it's got some, you know, junior high grade comedy that goes with it and snickering that goes on. But there is kind of some funny things that think if you think about it. I mean, the desecration of the corpses of our enemies, we're not supposed to do this. I mean, soldiers have gotten in trouble over doing such things in recent times. They have. I mean, it's just that's kind of how it is. We hear about stuff like this happening recently in Afghanistan and so forth. This is kind of like a major no-no. You're not supposed to do that. But can you imagine that if something happened like this today, the outrage that would be happening, that, you know, they went and desecrated their bodies and took, you know, 200 foreskins. That's kind of, you know, crazy. Nevertheless, it's representative of a couple things here. First of all, although we didn't read it, and we'll read it next time, David refers to Goliath as this uncircumcised Philistine. He said, I have slain both bear and lion with my bare hands, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them. Basically, it is a statement of contempt, of utter contempt, because in his economy of things, being uncircumcised is being contemptuous of the covenant that God has made with his people. It is to to mock God and to mock God's intention and to mock God's covenant. So that's what this is about. Now, there is this, of course, bitter irony that goes with this, but David does it. I mean, David pulls it off. I mean, surely one against 200, one of them's bound to kill him. But no. No, God's with him, and you can imagine the horror in Saul's mind when David flops this bride price. And that's another kind of chuckle thing there. I mean, how'd you like that for a dowry, ladies? Plops this thing down. One day, I'm getting the no from... When you're taking me out to lunch to talk about... No. Ask about the trophy. Anyway, so we have this. But we've got this craziness going. You've got Jonathan, Saul's son, who thinks David's great. We've got Michael, who is Saul's daughter, who thinks David's great. And kind of, well, for a while, she thinks David's great. And so Saul's got this really tough thing going on here. He's got a problem that even his kids think that he's great. So Saul is truly delusional, that nobody can reason with him. And that's an important thing, too, for us to recognize. We should never find ourselves in a place where even those who are closest to us and those who we serve the most, we don't listen to. That's an important thing for us to realize, because there are people who are close to us, who care about us and who have our best interests, and when we're not listening to them, that can be a serious problem. And Saul has that problem in a major way. So again, we see this, and again, we see that Saul recognizes. It's not like this is news to Saul. He understands the Lord is with him, and so therefore, instead of being repentant, he's more rebellious and runs away from David and rages more against it. So that's what goes on. Then Saul comes up with a great plot to try to kill David. And then Jonathan decides, well, you know, I better warn him of this because this isn't a good thing. Again, we see the whole thing about the harmful spirit from the Lord bothers Saul in chapter 19. This is another interesting story. Pick it up with Saul. Let's see here. What's the thing about? Trying to find that spot. Is this the one? Well, in any case, poor Samuel, poor Saul. Where did that part go? I'm sorry. It's eluded me. No, chapter 20 is about David not showing up for dinner. And that chapter 20, verse 30, of course, is really naughty. And again, why is it that I know all the naughty parts about the Bible? But it is. I'm looking for the part where David convinces Michael to put a dummy in bed. It's here. It's in verse 19. There we go. Okay. Yep, that's right. Okay. Verse 8. Pick it up there. And chapter 19, verse 8. Actually, no. First, yeah, 8's fine. Yeah.
And there was war again, and David went out and fought with the Philistines and struck them with a great blow so that they fled before him. Then a harmful spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand. And David was playing the lyre, and Saul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear. But he eluded Saul so that he struck the spear into the wall, and David fled and escaped that night.
Okay, there we have the problem again. We've seen that happen before. Okay, verse 11.
Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him, that he might kill him in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, "If you do not escape with your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed." So Michal let David down through the window, and he fled away and escaped. Michal took an image and laid it in the bed, laid it on the bed, and put a pillow of goat's hair on its head, and covered it with the clothes. And when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, "He's sick." Then Saul sent the messengers to see David, saying, "Bring him up to me in the bed, that I may kill him." And when the messengers came in, behold, the image was in the bed, with the pillow of goat's hair at its head. So Saul said to Michal, "Why have you deceived me thus, and let my enemy go, so that he has escaped?" And Michal answered Saul, "He said to me, 'Let me go. Why should I kill you?'"
Okay. Now, go ahead and keep going.
Now David fled and escaped, and he came to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and lived at Naioth. And it was told Samuel, "Behold, David is at Naioth in Ramah." Then Saul sent messengers to take David, and when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, and Samuel standing as head over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. When it was told Saul, he sent other messengers, and they also prophesied. And Saul sent messengers again the third time, and they also prophesied. Then he himself went to Ramah, and came to the great well that is in Sikru, and he asked, "Where are Samuel and David?" And one said, "Behold, they are at Naioth in Ramah." And he went there to Naioth in Ramah, and the Spirit of God came upon him also. And as he went, he prophesied until he came to Naioth in Ramah. And he too stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel, and lay naked all that day and all that night.
Well, there you go. Aren't you glad that preachers don't do that nowadays? I know for one that I am. As I said, I'm immensely grateful. But a couple of crazy things here. First of all, this is pretty crazy right here, that all of a sudden the Spirit of God comes upon Saul again another time, and Saul is prophesying. Now, this is some sort of ecstatic utterance. Exactly what it looks like, it's hard to tell. But somehow, it must be pretty wild, because he does... get buck naked or butt naked, depending upon if you're a buck person or a butt person. Don't know. As I said, that's up to you. I have never been able to figure out which is which, or which is the authentic. But nevertheless, he's as naked as a jaybird. I can say that. And he's prophesying. That is kind of strange. Now, let's just be honest with you. That's odd. But odder yet was something there in that first little episode. It's kind of funny, you know, as I said, it's a shtick, it's a comedy shtick that you've seen time and time and time again. Somebody puts a dummy in a bed and then sort of only to find out that it's a dummy. So again, this is an old shtick. But you notice something about that? What's the dummy? It's an idol. What's David doing with an idol in his house? The woman who gave us the woman. Yeah, well, I'm glad you recognize that, Rhonda. Anyway, the room full of people witnesses. It does. It sounds kind of crazy here. I mean, what's he doing with this teraphim or this image in his house? This is nuts. I mean, again, we don't have this picture of David. We don't have this picture of this. But apparently... we have to keep in mind that idolatry is incredibly pervasive in Israel even at this time. Now, this is kind of strange, because one of the things, this is what you notice about Saul, is that Saul's sins are almost always internal. And they're not the type of sins that Israel was committing. I mean, if you think about this, the sins that Israel was committing were the sins of Canaanite practices. Saul's been pretty good about getting rid of all that. But there is this strong character flaw in him that seems to supersede the issue of getting rid of the Canaanite practices. You will recall from last time, there was the passage where Samuel tells him to obey is better than sacrifice. It might appear, and again, there's nowhere in the scriptures that say it just like this, but you get the impression that Saul's on the up and up as far as religious practices go, as far as the roteness of it, as far as the form of it goes. I mean, after all, he's going to have this sacrifice, right? He's going to have this sacrifice. He's all on the up and up. But what's inside him is the serious problem. And that's the thing that over and over we see as a serious problem for Saul. Because he it's not that he doesn't connect with God in sometimes, because he does. It's not that matters of the spirit and matters of faith aren't unimportant to him, but there's a bigger problem in him. And we see this spinning out of control more and more. And the next episode is in chapter 20, where this spins out of control with his son. I joke about the eighth grade boy humor is in the Bible, and of course the chief among them is chapter 20, verse 30. Someone want to read that from the ESV? Anybody? Now, that's not what he said. Now, you know that, and I know that. That is not what he said. Nobody said. Now, you take a look in the footnote there. It says what he likely said. But actually, in the, this, you know, it's funny. The Living Bible, the good old Living Bible, which many, many of pastors and scholars have condemned for being too loose and this, that thing, it has exactly what you expect there. It has exactly what to expect there. And that's more than likely, no, he did not speak it in English, I can promise you that. But what would you describe a son of a perverse, rebellious woman as? I mean, you all know that. I mean, as I said, this is silly to write it this way. It's factual to write it the other way. We shouldn't talk like this. Well, Saul's the one that's saying it. We're seeing his anger. I mean, to the point where he's denigrating his wife, denigrating the mother of his children. I mean, this is a terrible thing. This is a terrible thing. But he is so upset here, and what he's upset about is this. He's upset because he thinks that his son Jonathan is taking sides with David, which in fact is not what's happening. His son Jonathan is just seeing the blessing of God upon David and is trying to convince his father that David's not a bad guy and that David is not out to get you. And yet he cannot see that for love nor money. Or anything. Again, you see this spiraling out of control. His daughter can't convince him. Those closest to him can't convince him. His son, Jonathan, whom he loves, who would probably be king after him. Jonathan recognizes, you know, here's the deal. I recognize that I'll probably not be king. And for whatever reason, the Spirit of God put in Jonathan says, I recognize that, David, you're probably the one that God has called to be king. Now, here's a sense of humility. That Jonathan can have that sense of humbleness to recognize what God is blessing. And again, it's not about us. And when we stop injecting ourselves into the conversation, when we start removing our own personal ego out of it, that's when God can do some great things and some amazing stuff. But the problem is this, it's hard for us to do that. I don't know if you know about you, but I mean, it's hard for us to disassociate ourselves from things like this, particularly when we think we deserve some credit. You know? I mean, isn't that how it is? I mean, you work hard and then, you know, the other person's getting the credit for. But it's not what this is at all. This is somebody who's working hard, who's someone who God is blessing. And we should say, yay, hooray. Surround yourself with people like this. Get yourself a whole bunch of Davids. You really should. It's kind of hard to work with, though. They're always going out and killing Philistines, you know, and chopping off their whatever. And so, you know, it's kind of messy, but you know, they said. But that, be that as it may, and they're all playing music all the time. They sound like millennials. That's what they sound like, for crying out loud. They do. David must have been a millennial. That's what it is. Anybody that is a parent of a millennial understands exactly what I'm talking about. This is what it is. Sorry, Larry. In any case, so David and Jonathan have this great affection for each other. I should point out at this time, just as an aside, just as a little bit of a rabbit trail here. It says that Jonathan loved David as his own soul. And Jonathan, in other places, said that he loved David with a love that surpasses the love of women. There are three places in the Bible that speak about how much Jonathan and David loved each other, which has led some people to suggest, guess what? Yeah, I mean, you hear this nonsense. But nevertheless, that is, in fact, nonsense, because that's not the case. That's what is being expressed here is the idea of incredible friendship and a godly friendship and a godly kind of friendship that they have as people who would see the bigger picture of what God is doing in someone's life. But you will hear people say that it is nonsense, just to let you know that, because it's silly to think. But nevertheless, I put it out there because somewhere along the line, someone's going to say, see here? In three places it says it. I bet you didn't hear that at church, did you? Well, yes, you did. So, be that as it may. There you have that. Okay, moving along, what happens next is that David recognizes, holy cow, this is not going to go well for me. I better skedaddle. Now, David decides to go to the beige part of Israel, the wilderness, and hide out there, because, you know, who wants to go there? He's going to go hide out in caves. And so in chapter 21, he decides, I need to get equipped. And so he goes to the priest, Ahimelech, and says, you know, I need to get outfitted, and he wants some bread. And there he gets some bread, which is the bread of presence, which is a major no-no, which is interesting, because this will come back again, this whole discussion of, what's holy and what's not holy is going to come up again. And so, as we have read before in our previous class, that there is this special bread that the priests make, and it's only for the priests to eat, called the bread of presence, and it's made on a regular basis. And David's kind of got some hungry folks and says, can we have some of that? And he takes some of that. Now, people might say, oh, they're not supposed to be doing that. Now, who do you think remembers this story and says, when somebody says, oh, you're not supposed to be doing that? Good godly people don't do that. Who do you think reminds people of this particular episode right here? Any ideas who that might be? Any ideas who this might be? Well, the Pharisees are the ones that are saying, oh, you shouldn't do this. But the guy that says, well, what about this? Jesus says, hey, take a look here. What's going on with this? You know, what's going on here? This is kind of fascinating that Jesus would make reference to this particular episode here because David... And the other thing is David is looking to get some weaponry. Now, let me explain something to you about the bit of the problem that's going on here. Because this is an important little piece of information here. Because something cool is happening here. Something fascinating is happening. Archaeologically speaking, there is a cultural... Well, anybody Star Trek fans? In Star Trek lore, the only way that, you know, the Federation can, you know, interact with a primitive species is if they achieve what technology? Warp technology. If they can figure out how fast beyond the speed of light, then they'll talk, because this is how the new technology is, and then they've sort of achieved this. I know this is all science fiction nonsense to most of you, but it's kind of cool. There's a whole movie that's based upon that. It's kind of interesting. But it's based upon some things about how archaeologists measure culture. And one of the ways that archaeologists measure culture, on what kind of tools do you use? Do you use Stone Age tools? Do you use advanced Stone Age tools? Do you use copper tools? Do you use bronze tools? Or do you use iron tools? And how is that progress delineated in your culture? Well, one of the interesting things that's going on at this time in the ancient Near East is the dawn of the Iron Age. Not everybody's got this technology. The Philistines, being advanced technological people, have got this technology. The Egyptians have this technology. The Israelites don't. They don't have this, which puts them at a decided disadvantage. If you want, do you want to go whack at somebody with a bronze sword when they have an iron one? I don't think so. If you know anything about metallurgy, you know this is a remarkably bad idea. This is not having good weaponry with you. As I said, you've got some pretty archaic weaponry. You will recall that the Israelites had to go and have the Philistines sharpen their plows and their hoes and their goads. Remember that from the book of Judges? Well, they don't have good technology. The Philistines, they got all the cool stuff. They've got all the cool toys. They got your iron chariot. They got your iron weaponry. The Israelites, they don't. Now, something's going to happen here. Saul is going to chase David away. And David's going to think that the only safe place for me to go is the place where Saul's really afraid to go. And where do you think that might be? To the Philistines. He goes there twice. And the Philistines are very suspicious of David. They think that he is, you know, one time he feigns madness. One time he acts like a drooling fool. Another time he lies to them and pretends that he's going out on raids against Judean and Israelite cities, when in fact he's raiding Philistine cities and completely wiping everybody out and then taking all the booty. So David's kind of an interesting guy there. But here's the most fascinating thing. And it's not in the Bible, except that all of a sudden, on the one hand, you see the Israelites struggling against the Philistines. Then when David becomes king, they stop struggling. It doesn't say in the Bible, but you got any guesses why that might be? They brought back the technology. This is called espionage. You know, this is how this works in the real. This is how the big kids play. You know, the big kids do this. They're good at spying things out, and the big kids have been doing this for a very long time. You think this is new? This is the best way to get a jump on the competition, is by stealing the competition's technology. Now, again, nowhere in the Bible does it say that that's what happened. But it is interesting that all of a sudden, when David becomes king, they've got the kind of technology that can put the Philistines in a hurt bag and deal with them effectively, as well as the Amalekites in addition to that, which they had a problem with before. So it's kind of fascinating what David's doing. Now, Saul drives in there out of Saul's race. He can't find him. Saul goes looking for David in a cave. Saul needs to... Saul needs to relieve himself, it said. This is, again, one of the more comical things. Saul needs to go number two. Let's just be, you know... Somewhat. Well, it's true, Margene. Do you say, I mean, it's a biological function, for crying out. And if you got to go, you got to go. You know, it's like churches. One of the worst features of this church. I love this church. Love it, love it, love it. But one of the worst features of this church. Anybody got ideas what it is? Bathrooms. Oh gosh. You know, and if you're a visitor and all of a sudden you have that biological need, you don't want to ask somebody because it's terribly embarrassing. You want to have a neon sign pointing to this thing of where it's at. I'm just saying, it's a true story. I love the sanctuary. I love the ark. It's great. I love coming here because it's just down the street from where I live. But I want to tell you something. The bathrooms are a problem here. And this is an interesting thing because David, when Saul goes to relieve himself, apparently he's in a cave where it's dark, and he happens to be doing this right next to David, which is, again, terribly ironic. Terribly funny. But what David does is that while he's doing this, David cuts off some of Saul's skirt, and then when he comes out and when he's got his business done, he waves it at Saul and says, "Listen, you know, man, I could have killed you right then and there, but I could not bring my hand against the Lord's anointed." And again, that's back to what you said, Bob, earlier. There are several spots where David says, you know, how could I bring myself to kill the Lord's anointed? That's a fascinating statement about David's loyalty. And if Saul had only taken the time to understand that, it'd be a whole different story. It'd be a completely different story. And sometimes we need to take time to recognize that people who we think are out to get us are in fact not out to get us, but have incredible loyalty towards us. Kind of crazy stuff, but nevertheless, it's there. So Saul goes chasing after David repeatedly. David goes back and forth. And David spares his life. There's all manner of things. But then something really nutty happens. Things go way out of control. And that's one of the things that you see in the Old Testament. When things go out of control, they go out of control in a big way. In a big way. Chapter 28. Let's pick it up there. Okay? You want to get that one? 28 verse 1.
In those days, the Philistines gathered their forces for war to fight against Israel. And Achish said to David, "Understand that you and your men are to go out with me in the army." David said to Achish, "Very well, you shall know what your servant can do." And Achish said to David, "Very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life."
Achish is the king of the Philistines, or one of the kings of the Philistines. So, we're going to put this to the test. Okay, read on.
Now Samuel had died, and all Israel had mourned for him and buried him in Ramah, his own city. And Saul had put the mediums and the necromancers out of the land.
Which is, let's give, again, props to Saul. Saul is doing the things that outwardly appear to be religious. This is Canaanite worship, and we need to get it out of here, and Saul has gotten rid of all this. Okay, read on.
The Philistines assembled and came and encamped at Shunem.
Mm-hmm.
And Saul gathered all Israel, and they encamped at Gilboa.
Mm-hmm.
When Saul saw the army of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. And when Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or by Urim or by prophets.
Okay, I'm going to stop right here just briefly. On Sunday, I mentioned to you the whole notion of revelation, the idea of God's revealed word, and that this is called special revelation. I can see that God created the world because I look out at a world that is orderly. I look out at a world that seems to have design to it. I can see that there is a watchmaker out there, so to speak, the divine watchmaker. I can see all that about and surmise that there is some sort of God out there, or some sort of designer out there that created all this. But watch out. You know, that designer, if that's all you know about God is that God's a designer, you know, God also designed some pretty nasty windstorms that sweep through here. Have you ever noticed that here? Have you ever been a part of one of those nasty windstorms that kind of sweep through this area? I tell you, it's something else. You know, when a tornado comes down, it will get your attention, friend. It will get your attention. Nevertheless, how do we know about a good and gracious God? That's through special revelation. And here we have three things that speak about special revelation. The first one is this, by dreams. Again, I mentioned that, you know, if you go out and get some Hebrew National Salami and have a midnight snack with Hebrew National Salami, you're going to dream in Technicolor. Promise you. You know, try it sometime if you can find Hebrew National Salami in Fargo. That's going to be your first task right there. And if you find Hebrew National Salami in Fargo and don't tell me, I will understand that you are not one of the trusted people I want to have next to me that does great things, okay? Just kidding. Just find me the salami for crying out loud. Anyway, but the next thing is that he goes looking for dreams. Urim, which are sacred dice. The priest had a breastplate that had the 12 stones right here of all the tribes, plus two extra ones up here. One was Urim and one was Thummim. They had names. These dice had names. And literally, that's what they would do. They would roll dice. These two dice, not just any dice, these two dice to see what was God's will. Now, that seems like kind of a screwy thing. It does seem screwy. But, I mean, I don't necessarily recommend it, but I have actually had an experience in my life where a guy and I, we were traveling across America, Andreas Armstrong, a buddy of mine, and we didn't know what to do. And we prayed over a quarter flip. Again, I don't necessarily know if that's a godly thing or not, but the quarter flip, I'm here today to say that I'm here today. So I guess it wasn't all that bad. Nevertheless, don't necessarily baptize that, but that's what we did. By prophets. Prophets also spoke the word of God. So here's three ways that the revelation of God comes forth. Keep reading.
Then Saul said to his servants, "Seek out for me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her." And his servants said to him, "Behold, there is a medium at Endor."
Wow.
So Saul disguised himself and put on other garments and went, he and two men with him. And they came to the woman by night. And he said, "Divine for me by a spirit and bring up for me whomever I shall name to you." The woman said to him, "Surely you know what Saul
is." Is this a sting operation? That's her first question. Is this a sting operation? Are you wearing a wire? Absolutely. Well, hey, again, we think that this is some sort of new thing that people think about. Nothing new here, friends. Yes, indeed. Keep reading.
"Surely you know what Saul has done, how he has cut off the mediums and the necromancers from the land. Mm-hmm. Why then are you laying a trap for my life to bring about my death?" But Saul swore to her by the Lord, "As the Lord lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing." Then the woman said, "Whom shall I bring up for you?" He said, "Bring up Samuel for me." When this woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice. And the woman said to Saul, "Why have you deceived me? You are Saul." The king said to her, "Do not be afraid. What do you see?" And the woman said to Saul, "I see a God coming up out of the earth."
Dang.
He said to her, "What is the appearance?" And she said, "An old man is coming up, and he is wrapped in a robe." And Saul knew that it was Samuel, and he bowed with his face to the ground and paid homage. Then Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" Saul answered, "I am in great distress, for the Philistines are warring against me, and God has turned away from me and answers me no more, either by prophets or by dreams. Therefore, I have summoned you to tell me what I should do."
Should have listened in the first place. This is a little after the fact, wouldn't you say?
And Samuel said, "Why then do you ask me, since the Lord has turned from you and become your enemy? The Lord has done to you as he spoke by me, for the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor David. Because you did not obey the voice of the Lord and did not
obey is better than sacrifice.
And did not carry out his fierce wrath against Amalek. Therefore, the Lord has done this thing to you this day. Moreover, the Lord will give Israel also with you into the hand of the Philistines, and tomorrow you and your sons shall be with me. The Lord will give the army of Israel into the hand of the Philistines."
Okay, let's stop there. This is a scary sight. And again, do not try this at home. This again is one of the more problematic passages of the Bible. The whole Bible, I mean the big one. Just as the ordering of chapters 16, 17, 18 is problematic, this also is problematic for a couple of reasons. But everything that deals with Saul is problematic. Number one is that, first of all, make no mistake, there is nothing minor or frivolous or harmless about engaging in any kind of spiritism. It's just not a good thing. I don't care what anybody tells you. I don't care what anybody says. It is not a good thing. It is not recommended by the Bible. As a matter of fact, just the opposite is recommended by the Bible. We need to be clear about that with each other and understand that in the most clear way. Not a good idea. Not a good idea. Very bad idea. But having said that, Saul, who understands that it's not a good idea, and Saul has been the enforcer of this, goes and says, I'll give this a try because I'm desperate. I'll try anything. And again, there is that problem right there, that sometimes out of desperation, we'll do incredibly stupid things. I mean, remarkably dumb things. Just way outside the realm of anything sensible. And he does this. But, and here's where the problem enters in, is that for all the world, it appears to work. It appears to work. Now, this has been argued in a lot of ways, that in fact, this is not Samuel coming up, but it is some demon who represents Samuel, or looks like Samuel, just to deceive Saul. That might be true, but it certainly sounds like Saul, looks like Saul, and the message that he gives is, Saul, you're in a heap of trouble, and very soon you will be dead. I mean, there's no deception here at all. None. None, 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 none. It is just nothing but the God's honest truth. Whoever this image is speaking the truth. Whether it's Samuel raised up from the dead, again, something that the Bible speaks against, or if it's some demonic force, whatever it is, or anything in between, it's saying the truth. This is what's going to happen. So it is a problematic passage. I'm just going to leave it at that. There are all sorts of ways that people have tried to rectify this, justify it, or explain it away. But again, it comes with the territory of Saul. The problems with Saul, you know, the whole business of an evil spirit coming from the Lord, the whole business of the chronology, the whole business of everything that's around Saul, that here's a guy that's supposedly on outward side doing what's right, but inwardly has got everything messed up. Everything that pertains to Saul is messed up. Everything that pertains to Saul is messed up. But wait, there's more. Chapter 31. Chapter 31. Go ahead with the first verse.
Now the Philistines were fighting against Israel, and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines struck down Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul.
Mm-hmm.
The battle pressed hard against Saul, and the archers found him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor-bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and mistreat me." But his armor-bearer would not, for he feared greatly. Therefore Saul took his own sword and fell upon it. And when his armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell upon his sword and died with him. Thus Saul died, and his three sons, and his armor-bearer, and all his men on the same day together. And when the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley and those beyond the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned their cities and fled, and the Philistines came and lived in them. The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. So they cut off his head and stripped off his armor and sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people. They put his armor in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan.
I've been there.
But when the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead heard what the Philistines had
remember
done
to... Remember Jabesh Gileadites? Remember those guys with the guys that were going to get their eyeballs plucked out? One of the good things that Saul does. Saul saves them. They didn't forget. What do?
The inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul. All the valiant men arose and went all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan, and they came to Jabesh and burned them there. And they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree in Jabesh and fasted 7 days.
It's not good. I mean, as you see the things unfolded, I mean, here you have the king of Israel not just defeated but humiliated, and not just humiliated, but also takes his own life. And then, if that weren't enough, you have the gods of the Philistines exalted by having the tokens of Saul's body and armor carried around into their places of their idols. This is not a good thing at all. This is not a good way to, by the way, just to let you know, I've asked you before about the various books of the Bible. As we've come to Genesis, I asked you, is this a way to end a book? As I came to the end of Exodus while they're wandering in the wilderness, and Leviticus when they're wandering in the wilderness, and Numbers when they're wandering, I asked you, is this a way to end the book? When we came to the end of Deuteronomy, there is Moses looking over in the promised land, but there dies. Is this any way to end the book? We see Joshua at the end of Joshua, and Joshua is hasn't conquered everything yet, and he's kind of looking at him and say, "Hey guys, you're starting to lose heart. As for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. What about all y'all? Is that a way to end the book?" And then when we come to the end of Judges. The end of Judges, what was the end of Judges? Anybody remember? And every man did what was right. There was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. Is that any way to end the book? Well, I got to ask you a question. Is this any way to end the book? I don't think so. We have an incredibly tragic situation. Here is the tragedy and humiliation that it saw. In being sent by his father on a wild goose chase to find his missing donkeys, only to be humiliated later, and by hiding among the baggage at his coronation, by being upbraided by Samuel regarding an unauthorized sacrifice, by his army following the victory of the Philistines concerning his rash vow, by being upbraided a second time by Samuel in the disposition of the Amalekite king, having a boy defeat the mighty Philistine that he could not, by his own foolish actions raging against David repeatedly, by his children's loyalty to David, by prophesying naked before Samuel in the matter of the witch of Endor, in his defeat in the battle before the Philistines, and have his body presented as a trophy of war by the Philistines. Could there be a greater humiliation? Here is an incredibly sad story. Here is the story of a man consumed by envy. Despite the loyalty of his servant, he is overcome by anger, brought on by the praises of his people for the successes of his servant and in his own service. But it says, "But when Saul knew that the Lord was with David and all Israel loved him, Saul was still more afraid of David." Likewise, his failure as a leader, good leaders, as I said, surround themselves with people that are competent, even more competent than they are, and let those people succeed. Saul again repents by saying, "Behold, I have played the fool." And that, my friends, is the epitaph for Saul. "Behold, I have played the fool," and let me submit to you, this is undoubtedly the saddest episode in the Bible. Nevertheless, this is no place to end the book. There's the good news, which we shall explore on the 3rd of January. Anybody got any questions or thoughts or observations? I've been chastised by Jarl repeatedly for not announcing your questions and your answers. So if you have any questions, observations, now's a good time. Your thoughts? Yes. In fairness. That's correct. It is not the end of the book. It is the place where they split it in two scrolls. However, mentally for us, we tend to put things like that. So yes. Okay. Other observations? Can God send an evil spirit? Bob, that's going to cost you lunch. No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding. That's a big question. I don't think we have time for the answer to that. It's not a small question, and I don't have all my notes here that I would want to answer that completely in full. It seems to say that. Try this one on for size. Is it Isaiah 45:9? What does it say? Someone got Isaiah 45:9? Isaiah 45:9, in the Revised Standard, it's a real doozy. I think it's 45:9 or 45:7, one or the other. Yes. Okay. It says somewhere, is it 45 or somewhere, it says, "Behold, I create good and I create evil." Ra, which is the Hebrew word for evil. This is a big question, Bob. It's not a small one. It's a big question because what is the nature of evil in the world? How do we understand evil? How do we understand evil in light of an omnipotent and all-powerful God? How do we understand that? That's why I'm not trying to be flippant with you, and I probably couldn't answer it over lunch either. But what I'm saying is this apparently is what the Scriptures tell us. Also, the Scriptures tell us some other crazy things here. It says God repented that he made Saul king. Since when does God repent? Now, other translations try to soften that up, but that's what it says, that God repented. This is tough stuff to get our head around. This is one of the harder parts to understand about the Bible. Again, as I told you, it has the most important part in it with regard to understanding the sweep of the Bible, but it also has, number one, the most tragic story in it, and in addition to that, some of the more challenging things to understand about the nature of God and what's going on here. Certainly, this is a Calvinist nightmare here. I mean, you need to understand that. This is an absolute Calvinist nightmare, this whole book of 1 Samuel. They freak out at this stuff. They come up with all sorts of goofy ideas about this, that, and the other thing. Because what do you say about God predestining things? I mean, where's that all fit in all this? This is nuts. Hey, Dave. How you doing? You've had a long day. Thank you so much. Yep. Sure. Thank you. Thank you. God bless you. God bless you. We know what we shall have for breakfast tomorrow, don't we? Is it possible that... Okay, is it possible that they could be in the right order? Actually, there are people who say that they're in the right order and that Saul was out of his mind. That's true. That's one perspective to look at it, yes. Another people say they're in the right order, but what it is that there are two groups of people telling two different stories. One's telling the story of David, one's telling the story of Saul, and they're not lining up. But yeah, it could be that he lost his mind. Yes, absolutely. Sorry, Bob, I wish I could give you a better answer. I'd be a pretty good theologian if I gave you a great answer to that one. I'd be well known in writing books and giving tours and all that sort of stuff if I gave an answer to that. But the problem is my reputation precedes me as it is, and you know. But I'm glad to be here with you, folks. I'm just glad that you love me and accept me. I'm just, you know, as I said, in spite of my reputation. Yeah. So I mean, I don't mean to be flippant. I really don't. It is a thorny question. I'll just say that. A thorny question which I probably do not have a sufficient answer, because when you look at it deeply in there, it's tough to argue against what it says in Scripture. It's very tough. It's very hard. Because it says that in several places, that God is the one sending this evil spirit to Saul. It says it not just once. I mean, if it was just once, we could figure something about it. But the fact that it says it repeatedly, we got to somehow get our head around that. Sandy, okay. In the Bible, probably. Okay, that God has power over everything, including evil spirits. Okay?
So that
Sure. Okay. Okay. All right. Basic stuff, but not a lot of thought. That's not true. You got a lot of thought, a lot of sanity. Monty, you got a comment? The information kiosk in heaven. There you go, right there. We need the information kiosk in heaven. This is why I love this book so much. This is why I have 71 pages of notes on. Can you imagine how much I have left on the cutting room floor? I mean, we'd be here all year just on this alone. But I love this stuff. I mean, that's just on this book. I have more notes on it than are actually in the book. Well, no, I actually now I have my theological man cave is back intact again. I'm a happy boy again. I have all the shelves up again. I have the books firmly ensconced where they belong now. So I'm a happy boy that my theological man cave has returned to how it shall be, world without end. Amen. I doubt that. But other observations. Time to go home. Live in the promise of that there is something more. And I guess that's important for us to realize that as Christmas rolls around, we live in the promise that there is something more. In spite of how unwieldy and out of control our lives get, because guess what? This is real stuff, isn't it? Because we certainly see parts of our own lives, parts of the lives of others whom we love and care about in the story of Saul and in these interactions. And we have to live in the promise that there is more. Let's pray. Father in heaven, for Jesus' sake, we thank you for the Christmas story, which reminds us that we live in the hope and the promise of the new age to come. Stir our hearts up to this end, for we ask it in Jesus' name, and all God's saints said, amen.